will I speak on behalf of everybody by saying a lot of thank you to Benoit and his team for organizing this, let me say, extended family meeting. When I say family meeting, that means that many of us have worked together for a long time, which has started, or not started, but was facilitated, for example, by the EquinoRisk project run in the first years of the 2000s, where we had several similar meetings, which I think were very fruitful in stimulating further research on this wonderful worm, which we all love, and has really, looking now at all the contributions and some of the phases, set up a kind of tradition maybe in some countries or in some institutes where further research has been done. I will come back to this project several times during my introduction because in hindsight it looks that it has been had much more impact than we actually envisaged when we were starting this project, which was, well, more symbolically funded at that time. But it facilitated us to work together as a group. Well, looking around, of course, I see many familiar faces which have worked together for a long time, but also there are new members of the family, let me say like that, which is also a very encouraging sign that this parasite is still attractive to new researchers. As you can see here, I have changed the title of my talk a little bit. This comes first from the fact that I find it a bit difficult to say something intelligent as an introduction for this session, repeating things which we all know. Also, I did not really want to preclude many things which will be repeated in the original contribution. So, what I've decided to do in this introductory talk is to ask a few questions and to try to identify things about this parasite which there are really gaps of knowledge. When I talk to colleagues from what we call developing countries working on other parasitic diseases, I keep being asked the question, why are you still working on this Echinococcus multilocularis? Surely in Europe, after so many years of research, there must be hardly anything left which you don't really know. So that's actually the first question I'm asking. Is there anything of importance we don't know yet of this parasite? And I think the answer is yes. So I want to talk about three different subjects. Geographical issues, very briefly. The question of frequency of the parasite. What do we know? What is the development? Are there any new data? And most importantly, about what I've called risk factors. That means, what are the underlying reasons for all these phenomena we see, for the geography, for the presence of the parasite or its absence. So let's start with the geography, and we may start as well with this beautiful map of the world distribution of Echinococcus multilocularis. This or similar maps are repeated in many books, but if you look at this, the area of presumed distribution, we have to be aware that there are many places where we have no real information. What we know quite well is some areas, of course, in Europe, but by no means in all parts of Europe. What we have a pretty good idea about is what is going on in parts of Central Asia, like Kazakhstan or Western China, Tibetan Plateau, for example. And what we know very well is the situation in Japan, in northern Japan, in Hokkaido. And thanks to the work of Bob Rausch and his friends, we know also quite a deal about what is going on in the Arctics, especially of North America. But there are many areas in between where we have only sketchy information. We are by no means sure whether this, what is put in this nice green color, is really a coherent area of distribution or not. So that's the first sort of word of caution when looking at these maps. Coming to Europe, let me start with this historical map, which is sort of the presumed distribution in the 1990s. I just put it here to remind all of us what has really changed in the last 20 years. For our younger colleague, 20 years may seem like ancient history, but for these old fellows like me, it is something a bit like yesterday. This was actually the textbook distribution of echinococcosis, multilocular echinococcosis in Europe, mainly based on the distribution of human cases by that time, because very little work has been done on the animal side. And I think it's also part of the success of this EchinoRisk group that we have accumulated a lot more data on the distribution in Europe. And this, as you can see, is by no means complete. It is also by no means correct. It is an approximation. It's just a sort of updated knowledge on what we know for sure. There are many question marks, especially in southeastern Europe or the eastern part, also in France. There is also this curious gap in Poland, which may have to be filled, I think so. Looking at the contributions today, we will have a lot of things which will contribute to a better understanding of this. There has always been this discussion whether the parasite has been spreading to new areas which were completely free of the parasite before. That's something which is still very difficult to answer. Certainly, it has to be evaluated for each reason, for each region individually, because for each region we have a very different quality of data which may support this or which may make this thing a little bit questionable. The most difficult thing is that in many areas we have no real baseline data from before this presumed spread of the parasite, so we cannot really say for sure whether these are new endemic areas or whether it is just an old endemicity area which has been newly recognized. Of course, in many areas there is a lack of human cases, for example, in the old times, which makes it very likely that the parasite has been introduced or it has been there at a low level and now it is increased in frequency. Generally, there is a problem to define non-endemicity areas anyway, because you cannot prove that a parasite or any other organism is absent from an area. It's just a matter of probability. All we can do is do a substantial sample size, finding no parasite, and then we can have a low probability of its presence. I think we will also have a contribution this morning about Scandinavia trying to attack this problem. There has been some role for genetic characterizations, and a number of papers have come out recently looking at the genetics of Echinococcus multilocularis, which also can have a contribution on this question, like the work of Jenny Knapp, which has started the kind of molecular epidemiology of this parasite and trying to answer some questions of a possible spread and possible core areas, which is something very interesting, but I think we have much too few data to really say something definite on this question. But it's a very promising technique. Like Northern Italy, yeah, where we have by Adriano and his group, which have have some substantial evidence that there is an autochthonous focus not introduced from elsewhere, but really being maintained in that area, maybe for a long time. So that's a promising avenue to explore further. Well, yeah, that graph with these isolates which have been tested on a molecular basis. And that's also interesting to say that's actually also an offshoot of the EchinoRisk project, because the samples have been collected already between 2001 and 2003 from these various contributing colleagues. So let's come to frequency. I would say frequency as the sort of the biomass of the worms per area. We have a lot of data from various countries on an increase of the parasite in foxes, measured as an increase in prevalence. This is just one example from southern Germany through the 1990s, where we see quite a substantial increase in the number of infected foxes, or let me say the prevalence in foxes. There is another example also from Bavaria, from southern Germany, demonstrating some increase in the pre-Alpine regions. There's a study from northern Germany, for example. I concentrate on the German studies because I don't want to preclude any data from other contributors. So there is a study from Lower Saxony, which also demonstrate an increase in prevalence. What those studies, of course, don't say is really the number of parasites, because we don't have only the prevalence as an important parameter, we also have the population density of the host, which is very difficult to measure and which is hardly taken into consideration anywhere. So the prevalence is only one factor, but it doesn't really, it's not the end of the story. If we take into account that during this period the number of foxes per square kilometer, for example, has increased drastically, we don't have only this increase between 12% and 20%. We have a much higher number of parasites compared to before. And this can also be corroborated by looking at the intermediate hosts. That's an old study from southern Germany, looking at infection rates in muskrats. And here you have a period between the 1980s and the late 1990s, and you can see an enormous increase in the same places with the same methods. So for southern Germany, for example, we can estimate, that's the order of magnitude, that's not an exact figure, that between the 1990s and the early 2000s, the biomass of Multilocularis has increased by the factor 10, at least in southern Germany. And that's probably true for many other areas as well. So what's the questions? Questions, first of all, looking at increases in prevalence or increases in the frequency of the parasite is always a bit difficult to prove due to deficiencies in sampling design of individual studies. Sometimes methods are difficult to compare. So looking at most individual studies, it is still a bit questionable, and there are always questions which may not completely prove that it's actually true. But looking at the entire picture, taking many studies together, we can see that there is a definite trend in most areas towards a prevalence increase from many of the countries I have listed here. It's always the same trend. We hardly have any study proving a stable situation or even a decrease in the number of parasites. What we don't really have very much is the recent trends. These are all studies done in the early 2000s until maybe 2005, 2006. So I think during this meeting we will have a lot of follow-up for the later period, and we will have some data on what is going on really in the actual time. Do we have stable situations? I just want to give you one example from our working area. This is in southern Germany, south of Stuttgart, the Swabian Jura, where we have looked at foxes from one particular very small area. It's just about 100 square kilometers. And if we look at the prevalence over the various years, starting with 2005, we can't see really much change. So the situation there seems to have leveled off. It seems to be a rather stable situation which we have there. And I'm sure the same is true for many other areas. Well, there's always the question, why is that so? So what first comes into mind is a certain correlation which we can see between the fox density and the prevalence rate, which has been demonstrated in several studies. Looking at the hunting bag in southern Germany, for example, southwestern Germany, that's very typical. We have a steep increase in the number of foxes in the late 1990s. but sort of from the year 2000-2002, it keeps leveling off. We don't have any further increase in the numbers, at least as measured by the hunting index. Rather, we observe maybe a little decline already. So it comes as no big surprise that even the prevalence rate does not or has sort of leveled off in a stable position. So here we are already with risk factors, trying to find a correlation, causal or not, with certain underlying factors. And as I already mentioned, obviously the fox population density is an important parameter for the parasite. This is an old map demonstrating that this increase in fox density is not something typical for southern Germany. It has occurred all over Europe, wherever the figures were available. So, again, the questions. Is fox population the density the important determining factor for the level of Echinomultilocularis endemicity? There is a lot to say for it. For example, this correlation, increase, temporal increase together with increasing fox density. But also there are some observations that certainly rule out that this is the only factor. There must be others. Because foxes, for once, they are much more widespread than the parasite. And also, if we look in endemic areas, we do not see a spatial correlation between fox density and Echinococcus multilocularis prevalence. The most glaring example is the urban foxes, where we see that in the urban areas, where we have the largest density of foxes, actually the prevalence is much lower than in the surrounding landscape. So fox density certainly is a limiting factor in some environmental conditions, but not in others. It's one factor of several. So the other important parameters, these little fellows, of course, the intermediate hosts. Intermediate host ecology, I think, is an extremely understudied issue, not only in echinococcosis, but also in many other diseases, many other zoonoses, which are rodent-transmitted. So looking at ecology of rodents, which is such an important thing for many diseases, one is surprised to find so few reliable parameters on rodent populations. Looking, for example, if we look at the... I always find this map very intriguing. This is the distribution of Microtus arvalis in Europe. And if you look at the distribution, it rather well coincides with the distribution of Echinococcus multilocularis. Now, I'm not saying that this is the only determining factor, but I think that is also something to explore if the parasite is really good, well adapted, for example, to this species. And the presence or absence of this species may be an important parameter for the parasite. That's speculation, of course. German speculation, if you want. Now we come to French science. You know this map. That's from the Doubs Département in France. It shows a correlation between the number of human cases and a certain ecological parameter, like in that case, the presence of permanent grassland and the proportion of permanent grassland on the total area. So that's a positive correlation. And it's been explained by the factor that on the grassland we have mainly two species, Microtus arvalis again, and the water vole, Avicola terrestris, which are prone to outbreaks. That means they have a cyclic population dynamics with some years of increasing populations and then population crashes and so on. And that apparently has some contributing factor to the presence and frequency of the parasite in that area. But certainly it can't be the only positive factor for the for the presence of the parasite, because if we look at this area, that's our study area in the Swabian Jura, we have a totally different landscape. We have a highly fragmented landscape with a lot of villages interspersed with forests, that's the dark areas, and fields and grassland. But if we look at the frequency of the worm, I show you the same map on the left side. That's a rather high prevalence. It's between 40% and 50% in the foxes permanently over many years. But if we look at population densities of rodents, that's on the right side, the blue line, that's Microtus and Arvicula. It's just a population index looking at the frequency of these animals. We see there we have no cyclic development. We have rather stable situations, certainly when it comes to Arvicula. There is a little more change when it goes to Microtus. The difference between years is a bit higher, but we can see no cyclic development. We have a much more stable situation. So even with stable situations of rodents, the parasite can adapt itself and be there in high numbers. So it seems to be happy in this situation as well. And that's not only true for southern Germany. I think in the French Ardennes, it's a similar situation where we have the fragmented landscape with a lot of stable rodent situations. So there's still quite little we know about the importance of rodents as for the maintenance of this cycle. Is it in particular linked to a certain species, for example, via preferred predation on a certain rodent species by foxes, or via better susceptibility to a parasite, better fertility, for example? Is a cyclic population dense dynamics, is it favorable or is it not favorable? Likely, continuing this line of research, we will find out that there is a diversity of factors depending on which ecosystems you look at. But there is still a big deficiency of data on that. So, a few other factors which are, or a few other developments which are contributing to a risk of this parasite. One of it is the alteration of host behavior. And the most important example, of course, is the development of urban foxes. Yeah, we all know this nice picture from Zurich, where it was demonstrated that the urban foxes actually are a discrete population, a subpopulation of the foxes, which don't have very much to do with the outlying rural foxes. And looking at this graph, which was made by Danny Hecklin some years ago, we can see that the population density of foxes actually increases towards the city center. We have much more foxes in the city centers than in the surrounding landscape, which is, of course, not reflected by the intermediate hosts. Here we have the intermediate hosts more in the outlying areas, and also the predation of foxes for on intermediate hosts is not in the city center. So the parasite actually clusters not where the maximum density of foxes is, but where we have a balanced situation between the final and the intermediate hosts. So that seems to be an important issue, that we have both on the side of the intermediate and the final host, we have to have an optimum density. Well, the parasite still seems to be well, but in urban areas. If we look at published prevalence rates from various cities, we also find some curious differences. Even in those cities like Zurich and Stuttgart, where quite a number of animals have been examined, we still don't completely know the answer for that. It most likely has something to do with the ecological situation in parts of those cities and the situation of the intermediate host. Likewise, what is happening in rural settlements, for example? Are these rural foxes, so-called rural foxes, are these really wild animals in the forest, or do they also utilize small towns or villages in the rural areas? Certainly in southern Germany, we found that they are very active inside the villages. This is a map of one individual fox which has been observed by telemetry for a long time. And you can see in the orange and yellow parts, that's the most frequent places of presence of this fox. we can see that the bay resting site is far outside the village, but at night the working place is in the city. That's where the fox actually forages. So we have a very adaptable behavior of foxes, which, for example, prey on rodents in the outlying areas, defecate in the cities or in the villages, and may therefore be, for example, an important link in the infection of humans. So, question again. Why are urban foxes not present in various towns? If I look at the place where I stay, in Stuttgart, for example, we have a lot of urban foxes. I live in a town which is 20 kilometers off. There is no urban fox. There's no observation. So is it a problem of migration? Has it something to do with the environment? Still there, we know very little about. This is something which has been proposed as a link between the wildlife cycle of Echinococcus and a domestic transmission of Echinococcus inside cities or inside towns by foxes infecting intermediate hosts, which in turn may infect pet animals like dogs or cats, which then may be important of transmitting the disease to humans. So we come to the factor of dogs and cats. Now that's a very dark spot. Certainly there is a lot of question marks in most of European countries. The role of dogs and cats. What we know is from a few studies that dogs which are at a high risk, that means rural dogs which have free living access to rodents, they can have acquired a high prevalence with or be frequently infected with Echinococcus multilocularis. But that's not certainly true for the entire dog population. There have been studies in Switzerland and there have been studies in Germany on the general dog population, which found a very, very small amount of, or very small numbers of dogs and cats infected. But that's certainly not representative of the entire population. So a lot of question marks are there. Likewise, susceptibility of cats. Of course, there have been these beautiful studies by Christian Kappel and the Swiss team on the experimental infections, showing that the worm feels very unhappy in the cat. But still, we find individual cats which have high worm burdens. And I would be very careful not rule out that such cats can in fact transmit infectious eggs. So I'm always at a loss when I'm asked by whoever, what about the cats? So it's a bit difficult, it's very tricky to answer. Question marks there. So also we have another development, the introduction of species to a country where they have not been present before, the so-called neozoa. One very famous example, of course, is the introduction of a Microtus species of a vole to Svalbard Islands in the Arctic, where there haven't been no small mammals before, and where this introduced vole actually established a local cycle of Echinococcus transmission. That's one example. But we have also other examples. Raccoon dogs, for example. Raccoon dogs have been introduced to Europe from Asia long ago, but only after the disappearance of rabies, they have started sort of increasing in population density and really also extending their range into Western Europe. So now we have a really high population density in Eastern and Central Europe, or parts of Central Europe. It's certainly a suitable host for Echinococcus multilocularis. We know from studies from Poland, from Eastern Germany, that they are frequently infected, but we still have very few data on the quantitative importance of this host in comparison to the red fox, and I think we will get some interesting data from Lithuania this morning on that. Another curious animal, the koipu, This is a large rodent which has been introduced for the fur production from South America quite long ago, and which seems to be doing well in the warmer parts of Europe. For example, in Germany, the animal seems to be spreading quite rapidly to areas where it has never been seen before. It has been assumed to be not a very good host for Echinococcus multilocularis by a study in western Germany some years ago. We have repeated that study in southwestern Germany, and we found that's not so. We have a high proportion of this rodent infected, almost 10%, with very fertile large metacestodes. In fact, it's the most highly infected rodent in the entire area, compared, for example, to muskrats or to the small rodents. Whether it has an important part in the life cycle, maybe locally, we don't know, because we don't know really the predation rate of foxes on this animal. We don't know the absolute frequency of numbers in compared to other rodents. So these are also questions which need some answer. So I said it is a family meeting, so knowing from my wife, which comes from a different continent where family meetings are much more important than here, I have an extensive experience in that. And I know that the uncles shouldn't talk too long. So I want to finish that and say thank you.